Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, was so much younger.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. When I mean us, I mean Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and at his home lake studio facing the water, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing really good. How important is it that we have an identity as to who we are and that, you know, that who we belong to? And as Christians, we know who we are and we always need to remember whose we are. And when you don't have an identity in Christ, you're going to spend a lot of time looking for one.
It just took away what I was going to say.
Cool.
So what do you think about the Wild going to the playoffs?
I'm pretty excited about it.
That's it. And what I wanted to talk about tonight is step one. And that's we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and that our lives are unmanageable. And most of the time, Bill, we spent time thinking and talking about how we're powerless over everything, not just our drugs, but our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. He allows it, he directs it, he controls it. But also, we're powerless to learn about who God is without his word and the Holy Spirit and prayer and other believers. And we don't talk about this enough. The goal here is to not stop a sinful behavior. That's part of it. But you have to put off the old, you have to put on the new. And I was listening to the Faith Radio Network this week, and Colin Smith, I believe, was talking about Jesus the priest sacrificing himself for us. It's done. It's over. What I have to do is walk and be obedient. And it struck me that that's the way it is with recovery, too. God is drawing us in, telling us in our heart that I don't want to do this anymore, and I have a way out for you. We're all in, guys, as addicts. We need to get all in on this and trust it. Trust it enough to do it. Do it enough to make it work. Be in the Word. Bill, one of the favorite things I've gotten from you over the years is when you talk to the guys at the Salvation Army about who God is. And they tell you, and you go, that'd be tough to worship that God. Why don't you look at the Bible and see who God really is? And that's what I wanted to talk to you about tonight, that we're powerless to learn about God, I think, unless the Holy Spirit gets in there. And we do our part, but God opens our eyes to it. And it gets back to trust and faith. Am I really going to be better off quitting what I love doing, drinking, drugging, even though it's killing me? That's always the hard part. I really don't want to do this, but I don't want to keep getting what I'm getting. But if you work the steps, what happens is God changes you into a person who doesn't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He gives us the desires that he has for us.
And the whole thing is invitational. God always has an invitation for us. Come and see. Follow me. Believe in me, abide in me. It's always so invitational. And when you talk about why would you want to give up these behaviors, even they're so self-destructive, is because you have not looked at or received this beautiful invitation from God's kingdom to step into a new relationship with him. And that's where everything changes.
Yeah, that's so good. Taste and see that he is good.
Yeah.
And it gets back to step one. I think I know what God wants me to do. I think I know who he is, but I'm clueless about it. And do I really trust God? And that's where we all struggle our whole life. But the more you trust God and look in the rearview mirror to see that he's had you all the way, I get real peace of mind about that.
Yeah. And George, if we look at step one, a lot of addicts will start off in a recovery room filled with guilt and shame and remorse, and maybe they just don't like themselves. And that is baggage that God wants to remove. God wants to take that, and just the way he took it to the cross, and he wants you to be liberated from all of that?
You know, guilt and shame are a great topic. And for me, the real simple way to look at it, guilt, good. I feel bad about what I'm doing, as I should. Shame, bad. I feel bad about who I am. And that's never productive. But if you don't know you're a child of the King, it's pretty hard not to be in shame, Bill.
Mm-hmm. And how important is that surrender in step one? I'd love for you to talk about that in the two minutes we have.
How much time do we
two,
have?
Two minutes.
You have 5 seconds? I'm an expert.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think we get beaten into a state of reasonableness that forces us to surrender that nothing else works. At least that's my experience and a lot of people I know. And when we walk in our faith, we start giving more and more of our thoughts to surrendering to His will for us, not my will for Him. Because ironically, it works better for us too. We're designed by God to have a relationship with Him. Nothing else is going to work. And when you taste that, you surrender more and more and more of your life. And it's an ongoing process. You need people in your life. Iron sharpens iron, just like one man another, so one man another.
Mm-hmm.
And we need people to tell us, you know, we have a good relationship, Billy, that we have permission to tell each other that we think we're doing the wrong thing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And we ask, what do you think? You need people like that who know the Bible. And as I get older and closer to going home, my desire to learn more about God increases every day.
Amen.
Do you find that, Bill?
I do. We're already at the point where, George, we're going to take a little break and bring in our special guest, Rolando. We're looking forward to hearing his story. You listen to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. We were just voted 22% better than our foreign competitors. That felt good, George. You must have heard about that.
Yeah, very, very humbling, Bill.
Yeah, it was very humbling. We're humble guys.
Yes, we are.
We're here to serve.
And we should be.
Yeah, we're glad to have Rolando with us tonight. He's got quite a story, and we're excited to hear it. And awfully glad he could make time and his busy schedule to be here. Rolando, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So we want to hear all about you and your story and where you're from and when you started getting involved in using anything, substance, alcohol. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm about 30 years old right now.
Okay.
I'll admit that, I guess.
That's fine.
When I was born, my road to addiction actually started way before I was introduced to drugs and alcohol. My mom, when I was born, she was actually incarcerated. She was in prison due to her drug use. She was addicted to crack cocaine and, you know, buying and using drugs and that whole lifestyle. And it resulted in me literally, like, physically being born into a prison.
Were you born in prison?
Yeah, in the Shakopee Women's Correctional Facility.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so because of that, after I had to go live with several different family members in South Minneapolis, and, like, 90% of my family members consisted of everyone using drugs, selling drugs and involved in some type of crime and gang mm-hmm. activity, from my great-grandmother down, like everybody. It was just a way of life. Everybody was, you know, took on this identity of the hustler or the people that are using and selling, and it was just a way of life. But everything that came along with that was unhealthy, I picked up on as well. You know, the not knowing how to love or receive love, or I wasn't allowed to speak out about, like, my emotions and feelings, because no one else wanted to talk about theirs. So I was taught just to not talk about it and mm-hmm. not deal with it, that we just, life goes on, things, you know, put your feelings aside and man up and all these other things. And it was super unhealthy. You know, I tried to reach out, you know, as a kid, I didn't know my father. I grew up from a mixed background. My mom was Mexican and my dad was black mm-hmm. and my family had Native American, Caucasian, African. It was super diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And, I suffered from the identity crisis because my dad was black, but the rest of my family was Mexican or, like, brown skin. So, like, I didn't know where I was supposed to be and who I was supposed to be. And I didn't have a positive role model to really look up to. Everybody that I knew were just unhealthy and gang activity. So I kind of was reserved all the time, and I was scared to reach out and ask questions like, you know, where's my father or where's my mom? Why isn't she in prison? All these things. And I wouldn't get validated for anything. I would just be told to put it on the back burner and move on. So I had goals and stuff. I liked sports. I liked getting I wanted to be big and strong like The Rock. I wanted a professional wrestle, but minus the tights. I wasn't trying to wear spandex and all that. So I played sports, but sports brought a lot of emotions and things out of me because it was the only thing I had that would get me out of bed in the morning. But at the same time, it brought up things that I didn't have. Like, I'd see other family members of teammates rooting them on and cheering them on in the game, taking them out to eat, and I didn't have that. Like, when I'd score a touchdown or something like that, my family's off, like, getting high somewhere and probably didn't even know where I was at some of the time. And so it was bittersweet, but I kept going, and it made me envy that whole happy lifestyle or what I thought was because that was the first time I was exposed to it. I moved around schools a lot because my mom was in prison and my family was super unhealthy. So depending on who was sober long enough or stable long enough or just had a bed for me, I would have to move around. So I never went to one school for more than a year. I went to like 12 different schools, I think. And bouncing around, that meant me leaving sports and being the new kid at home, at school, and not having football. And everyone's emotionally and mentally unstable, and I don't even know how to process this at a time. I don't even know really too much about life. I tried to get back into sports. It was rough because, you know, I got pulled off of one team, and now two-thirds of the way through the season, so now it didn't really work out. So I stopped playing sports. I played basketball, baseball, football. I tried them all, but at this point, it was kind of rough. I didn't have the support financially from family. So I was still going to school, and I started skipping school a lot because I was the new kid. I'm socially awkward, not knowing how to talk to people or relate to people. And I didn't want to, you know, I was scared. I thought they were going to neglect me and treat me like my family did. So I was like, okay, well, I'll go to school and find a spot in school to just hang out until the bell rings and go home and say that I had a good day.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do that. And I got introduced to kids that were using drugs and, you know, smoking weed and doing all this and that. And the first time I got introduced to weed, it was, you know, they were, you know, I was hiding in school, skipping school, and these kids offered me some weed. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't really smoke or not. But like, I felt what I call the fear pressure, the fear of rejection, fear of, you know, being different. And I was like, okay, well, if I say no to these guys, they're going to possibly tell on me for where I'm skipping school at, or they might think that I'm going to go tell on them for smoking. So I jumped in, started smoking, and it was, didn't really like it, but it was just the thing to do. And it was normalized at home. Family, everyone smoked, used drugs, sold drugs. And I was told when I was younger in school, like, you know, you do drugs, you're going to die. Well, I smoked weed and I didn't die. So I'm like, okay, well, if I didn't die, it's not that bad, mainly. And my family's doing it, so it couldn't be wrong. And on top of that, so I started smoking just to fit in and, you know, recreational purposes. And then I started learning trying to use it to cope with my mental and emotional health. When I was sad, I'd smoke. When I was mad, angry, getting abused at home, I would smoke to make that go away or to try to forget about it and drown it out. Well, to make matters worse, at home, I had family. They would, I would babysit and do things around the house, and I would get paid by family members in weed, in large amounts of drugs. And like, here, go and sell them. I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. And they taught me how. And it was the overall theme of my family. So I'm like, okay, well, this can't be that bad. This is the only, and on top of that, my family's teaching me something for the first time. Like, it must not be that bad. I don't know what everyone else on TV or the news, all this is talking about. Like, from my great grandmother down, everyone's doing it. So I jumped in, and now I'm getting attention from my family. And now people at school are, you know, looking for me to sell them weed or do, you know, smoke with them and do all these things. So I found real quick, like, I found the answer to my loneliness and depression, that, like, if I do this, if I have drugs or use drugs, my family is accepting me and encouraging me, and people want to know where I'm at, what I'm doing, and people care about me. And that's all I ever wanted, was someone to acknowledge that I exist. And so I picked that up real quick. I figured that I needed to do this in order to be loved or accepted. And I kept trying. The weed stopped working after a while. The marijuana didn't work as much, and I kept chasing things. And I switched schools. My family was like, you know, we're going to move you to the suburbs. I went to Prior Lake High School, and it was a culture shock. You know, out there, people didn't look like me. They didn't talk like me. We listened to different music and whatnot, all these things. So I was like, okay, I'll be a loner. You know, that lasted for about 2 days because I didn't like being alone. I was like, I need people, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, I know how to relate. I'm socially awkward. On top of that, I'm a burnout from smoking marijuana now. And I was like, I know how to relate to people. I'll go sell everyone in the school that's smoking weed. I'll go sell them weed. So that's what I did. And in the process of doing that, overnight, I had people that I could call friends and relate to. And they introduced me to what they were doing, which was ecstasy, Molly, all different kinds of hallucinogens. And the fear of rejection again or being left out, I jumped into that. And now I'm dealing with my problems by getting high. Now it's not everyone else around me was just doing the partying thing. But me, I was trying to, you know, suppress my emotions and my feelings and my hurts. And I don't know who I am. It's the only way I know how to do it. So it kept getting worse and worse. The drugs got more severe. And my family didn't, they would say, you know, you got to get sober, this and that. But then they would buy and sell and push me to use drugs. And it was super confusing, you know, everybody. You know, and then, you know, I got kicked out of that school for not showing up, you know, for using drugs in school. I went to a couple ALCs, and with the same context going into it, trying to meet people, the only way I knew how, the only skills I had were these drugs. Like now I have all, I'm trying more drugs to relate to more people, because then that's more people that I can consider friends or that know my name and I exist to them. And I did that, and I got introduced to Xanax, Percocets, promethazine and codeine, all these other things. And that the Xanax swept the legs from underneath me. It hit different because I suffered from anxiety, depression, personality disorder, and all these other emotional things that I didn't even know how to identify. And that made them all go away. It took away my insecurities. It gave me confidence. But at the same time, it made me fearless when it comes to trying new drugs. And now I took on this party, this party role and the sociable guy role that on the inside, I couldn't do without drugs. Like, I was scared to even introduce myself to people. And I didn't care about the consequences of any of my actions, what I was doing, and I started getting kicked out of school more. I got kicked out of school permanently. Now I'm running with a rougher crowd of all the other people that are burned out and family members and distant family members that are using drugs and selling drugs. And that's what I did. Now I started getting in trouble a lot because I wanted to fit in with these crowds, and I'm living in the suburbs, and I'm going back to the inner cities to get drugs, and I have to play that role in order to fit in. So now I'm trying to impress two different types of people, and then, you know, there's the gang activities, all that, and I never, like, was in a gang or anything like that, but everybody I was around was affiliated in my family and stuff like that. So I had to do things to, like, prove myself, to act tough and do all these things that I didn't really want to do, and that didn't last long because I wasn't built for that. Really didn't have no direction in life. I started going in and out of jails. I've spent 7.5 years altogether in prison and jails from 18 till 30 or from 18 till 28. I spent 7.5 years in and out institutions, start overdosing. I've overdosed probably like 4 times. I've went to treatment like 5 times. Things kept happening in life. I started having friends overdose to the point where it became normal. I became desensitized to it. Like, best friends that I grew up with were just overdosing and dying. I just had to get used to it. And I would get sober, you know, I'd go to treatment for a while, get out, and be like, okay, well, I'm going to get sober for this person, and I'm going to do it for these reasons, and then someone else would do it, and I wouldn't know how to deal with my emotions, and I'd go right back to it. It'd be a propellant to keep me to get high and running from myself, and I didn't have no direction. I tried reaching out to people in my family, and it didn't work, you know, so I kept everything to myself, and I burnt every bridge that I had in life, like everything. I didn't know how not to burn bridges and stuff like that. The prison I had, I didn't like prison. It was, it made me, I had to force myself to act like a certain person to get by and take on this, you know, this druggy moniker or this role. Like, it doesn't affect me. And, you know, I'm tougher than this, and all the things that when things got rough when I was a kid that my family would tell me to do. Well, now that's just a part of who I am now at the time. And it threw me off. I came out a worse criminal than when I went in. Mindset wise, because I just didn't care. And I was like, this is a way of life. My family treated it as a rite of passage. So I'm like, oh, well, now I'm really lost. I don't know what to do. It became a revolving door. Well, about a year and a half ago, I got a fleeing officer. I got in a chase, and I had drugs on me. I had some methamphetamine and some hallucinogens on me. And I rolled the car and I ate a bunch of drugs and got tased and went to jail. I overdosed and went to the hospital and then went to jail. And the judge was giving, he said, you know, you're facing 130 months. Like, what do you want to do about it? And me, you know, with a hard heart and living the way I was and trying to be that person, I'm like, well, just give me 90 months and I'll do boot camp, which is an early release program, because that's all the things that I've heard people say in them situations, like, this is what you're supposed to say, this is what you're supposed to do. And he was like, no, well, that hasn't been working for you. You've done all these years and nothing's changed. Like, have you heard of Minnesota Adulting Challenge? I'm like, yeah. I was like, okay, well, you're not going to let me go anyway, so why are we talking about it? He's like, you plead guilty to all these charges today, you can go tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, fine. Like, I'll go in the front door, out the back door, and be back to doing what I was doing by Friday. Well, didn't work out like that. Did not work out like that at all. I got in there, and right off the bat, people were opening up, talking to me about, like, you know, my feelings and my emotions and all these other things. And I'm like, it made me want to leave at first because I wasn't used to it. But then there was guys that were bigger than me and tougher than me, been through the streets, and, you know, like, just big, strong dudes, tattoos and everything. And they're asking me about feelings and emotions. I'm like, well, this is weird. Like, and I'm not going to make fun of him because he's tougher than me, so I'll listen, you know. Mm-hmm. And it made me uncomfortable because these are all the things that I wanted my whole life that I never got, that didn't have an ulterior motive or, you know, intentions that were negative. Like, these people didn't want me to use drugs with them. They didn't want me to sell drugs. They didn't want me to do crime with them. They weren't trying to rob me. And I was like, I'm not going to leave here until I figure out what's going on or what's here. And I dug in and I met Jesus, you know, and everything changed. But I did the extended program. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's a 13-month program. I end up doing 18 because I'm hard-headed and learn things the hard way. I came in with a prison mentality, like, okay, I'll just learn how to do the right things and say the right things and just get by. And this will be the easiest prison sentence I'll ever do. Well, that worked fine in that sense until about, you know, going through the COVID and all that. And I got during COVID, about July, I got a pass to go on to see family after being, you know, in quarantine for so long. And I went out to see family. They threw a barbecue for me. And this is all my family that are still in active addiction, all these things. And they're like, yeah, you know, you're doing so good. Congratulations. You don't have to use drugs. You can just sell them. And it created a bunch of confusion in me. So I'm like, and I came back to the program and an opportunity presented itself where I used in the while in the program. And it was almost like self-sabotage. Like, I felt like a fraud. Like, I'm saying all these things, doing all these things. And on the inside, I'm still a mess. And that kind of drew it out. Well, they didn't kick me out, which was usually unheard of, because usually that's an automatic boot.
That's an automatic, yeah.
You know, but Pastor Rich, he saw something in me which I didn't see in myself. And they gave me another chance, and I was like, okay, well, I was ready to leave anyways because I thought they were going to kick me out, so I'll run before they make me leave. But I stayed, and I was like, all right, well, if Jesus is real, how you guys say, how everyone says he is, like, okay, well, I'm going to find out what this is about. And I dumped all my garbage out, and I had to remove a lot of mental and emotional barriers and things in my life that prevented me from trusting in a father figure and getting to know God. And it happened. I started spending time in prayer. I started meditating. I started singing in the choir, which I never thought I would ever do. And slowly things started to change. I had a hard heart, but I had to put my family on the back burner, and everything I thought that was life and what I believed, I had to put it aside and admit, like, okay, well, everything I was wrong. It was a lie. I fabricated a lot of who I thought I was, and I don't know who I am. And slowly things start opening up, and I built a relationship with God, and everything changed.
Wow. All right, George, you and I have got some questions to
ask.
Yeah,
sorry, I can go on forever.
Oh, no, you're doing great, Rolando. We just need to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Rolando. Quite a story so far. George and I have got lots of questions. Be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George, Ryan is on the board tonight. George, if I were to suggest that we do a pop quiz on Rolando's life so far, it's be hard to follow. A lot of things have happened, starting off with being born in prison.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm interested, at what point at Teen Challenge did you wonder what everybody's angle is? What do they have that I don't?
It would have to be the point where I relapsed and I was ready to leave, and under normal circumstances, that's an automatic out. But the people there, they saw something, especially Pastor Rich, Pastor Terry, especially Tim Walsh, they saw something in me that they would tell me, and I didn't know what. And I still to this day, I go ask them, why did you let me stay? Like, why? And I felt like I wasn't worthy. I wasn't good enough. And I'm like, okay, well, I got to figure this out. Like, this must be real. And they went out of their way personally, especially Pastor Rich, to check in on me and take me out to these donor dinners and like just to talk with me. And like, there's so many people in the program that doesn't happen. So I'm like, okay, there's something going on here. And that was, I feel like God's way of reaching to me from like the top dog in the program down to me. Like, it usually doesn't happen. I'm like, why is he taking the time to come and push me and encourage me and steer me? And I had multiple people doing that. And I'm like, okay, they don't get paid millions of dollars to do their job. So I mean, it's not money, and like, they care. And just seeing them like on the front lines during the COVID and the social unrest and the evacuation, the way they showed up and the way they cared for us out of love and the patience, it was a hard time. And we went through that struggle together and nothing changed. The love was still there. And I'm like, okay, well, now this is family. And this is who I'm going to call family. This is where this makes it real. Mm-hmm. There's things we went through and the way they went about, and they didn't kick me out. So I was like, oh, so I got to figure this out. And that was kind of the pivotal. So I started the program completely over. I dumped the whole facade of having it made together, and I was doing so well, dumped everything out, and then, like, I just skyrocketed from there. Like, it got real.
Nice, nice. So it sounds like there's some interesting things in play right back from when you were a younger kid and looking for your own identity, looking for the place where you belong, where you can hang out and be a part of, where you matter. Where people are listening and understanding and your feelings can be shared. And none of that took place until you got in a safe Christian community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Billy, what happens is we see people that have something we want. They're happy not using. They're unconditionally loving me, letting me stay when they should kick me out. That's the rule. You use in rehab, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? So you want what they have, and you have a curiosity of, you'd like that too. So you want what they have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it. And that's when the process kicks in. You know, then we have a hunger here, excuse me, to be like there.
Mm-hmm.
I want what you have.
And Rolando, you were seeing that as well, weren't you? You were around other guys that were bigger and had more tats, and they were listening to you and asking you questions and being kind to you.
And seeing them go, people that I've seen even in prison or in the streets, and seeing them just be who they are and what they're doing, it was like, and talking about feelings and emotions and getting emotional, it's like, it gave me permission to do it as well. Because in my life, in my family, I've never seen anyone do that. And if it was because they were under the influence. But to sober and just experience emotions and tell me why they're doing their job is because God did something for them and they want to introduce me and show me the way and show me what saved their life. I'm like, all right, well, tell me what I got to do. And Teen Challenge is pretty good about giving you an itinerary on what to do and how to mm-hmm. do it. And at the time, I fought a little bit in the beginning of the program, but this, I dug in and I chased it down, and it everything changed. And it was just, I got filled with something I didn't know how to explain. And I'm big on questions. I had to ask questions. And someone gave me the book, Letters of a Skeptic from Greg Boyd. Mm-hmm. And that covered a lot of questions. Like, I got no more questions. So now I constantly read anything by C.S. Lewis. I'm in. My next book I'm reading now is The Confessions of St. Augustine.
Wow.
I read a lot.
You're reading good stuff, too. So I'm curious about your family upbringing. And did you find, with your mother being Mexican and your father being Black, did you find that you had a difficult time being accepted by both groups?
Absolutely.
Isn't that interesting?
My father was Black. I don't know who he was. My mom's Mexican and with a little bit of German, and my family's mixed with Mexican and Native American.
Okay.
And all three of those are like super racist against each other in a way, and judgmental. And I'm seeing it from all sides, and I don't look like a lot of my family. So I got exposed to it, and I'm suffering from my identity crisis. I don't have a powerful, like, positive Black male or any male in my family to compare, like, this is what I'm supposed to be, this is what I'm supposed to look like. So I got confused. I was a chameleon, and I hated myself because all these family and people I was around that didn't like the other races, it's like, it's all pointed at me because I was all of them. And I didn't know how to deal with that. So I tried to fit in. If I was around this crowd, I would try to be them. If I was around this crowd, I would try to be them, to the point where I didn't know who I was. And it was depressing. I wanted to hurt myself, only I was too scared. I was too prideful to commit suicide or to try. I didn't want people to think that, oh, well, he committed suicide. That's how he died. That's what happened. I didn't want that label. So mm-hmm. I was like, me, self-harm was using as much drugs as I can and labeling it partying. I started getting in like high speed chases, thinking that the cops would take me out and all these things. And it never happened.
And you had 4 ODs?
Yep.
Yep. And I would imagine each one of those was a near-death experience?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then the 7.5 years in prison over a period of, what is that, about 12 years?
Yep.
Roughly. Did you find that time was at all restorative, or was it just survival?
It was survival for the most part. Okay. I went through like CBT treatment in there and learned about my thinking a little bit. But like for me, it was easier to get sober. It was hard for me to stay sober and find a reason why. And when I was in prison, I was around other people that didn't want to get sober. They didn't want to stop doing crimes. So it was hard. It was very hard for me to grow in that environment because everyone had these motives there, whether, you know, they were just there doing their time. They didn't really care. And I was still a chameleon even in prison. Just like in my family and in my youth, okay, I'm going to be what these guys are to get by. So I was stagnant or came out worse. But like when I'd get out, I would do really good, but I would be sober. Like I've gotten jobs where I was in the union, I was a welder, got my credit score up pretty high, leased a new car, but then I'm still me dealing with life's problems. Just because I don't have any drugs in my system doesn't mean life's just going to be roses and rainbows. Like, mm-hmm. And that was really hard for me, and I would self-sabotage because I'm dealing with loneliness, isolation, feeling unworthy, and feeling like no one cares, and I didn't know how to feel that.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, Rolando, when you were growing up, because of the dysfunction of your family, there was no church attendance of any kind?
No.
Yeah. None. So there was nothing on Sunday that the family gathered and went to, and there was no youth group, there was no place where you could go and just be part of a gathering of other young men and with adult leadership and that kind of thing?
No, the only time that God was brought up when everyone was in trouble and it was time to pray.
Okay.
Other than that, Jesus was a guy on a chain that people wore.
Yeah, right. And then the whole idea of being in sports in high school and being relatively accomplished in sports, yet no one to celebrate your accomplishments with. So it's kind of a bittersweet experience.
Yeah, and I just feel like I couldn't win. And sports were the one thing that I had, you know, I wanted to go play for the U of M, wanted to play professional football, but I didn't have the support financially mm-hmm. or physically or emotionally or mentally. I feel like if I would have had that, like a lot of things everything would have been different. Because I'm like, if my family's not pushing me to do something, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be doing it. And the things they would push me to, they're usually bad.
Yeah. It's funny because George had the support. He just didn't have the talent.
Yeah, you know, my little league team put me on waivers.
I know. I remember that. It was heartbreaking.
It was deserved. I think I met you. You were down. Were you down at Portland working the front desk for a while when we walked in?
Nuh-uh.
Okay. Then I didn't. I'm really interested in how you can do the right thing, guys, when you don't know who you are. And if we're a child of the king, we don't live on the streets going through garbage cans for food. But if we don't know that we're a child of the king, how can you do the right thing if you don't know who you are? And I think at Team Challenge with Walsh and Pastor Rich, you get a real good example of being a child of the king. And you didn't have great examples before. So what are you going to do? You're going to do what you see, right?
So I had halfway through my program, right after I relapsed, I got introduced to a mentor, got a great mentor. And it was him and his wife came in and do a chapel service one day. And Pastor Rich, usually there's a whole process to go through to get a mentor. And Pastor Rich just bypassed all that. He was like, hey, you guys come meet this and that. And he's actually a judge. His name is Judge Rosh for the appellate court. And he's an African-American man, child of God. He's never been into drugs, alcohol. And he was my mentor. And it was crazy how it worked out because it just, you don't have a lot of mentors like that. And he came in and he started coming to see me every single week, taking me out, like out of his, you know, take time off work to come invest in me. And now we had to have some tough conversations. I remember specifically one conversation we had in the judge's chambers at the appellate courthouse, the federal courthouse in St. Paul. And I got to trust him enough to have that conversation. I'm like, look, I don't know what it means to be a black man. I don't know. I never had no one to compare it to. I didn't know how I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to talk like. and explained to him a lot of my story. And he pointed everything back to Jesus. Like, your skin color doesn't matter. It's what God says. What God says, who you are and who you're supposed to be. Anything outside that doesn't matter. And that changed a lot of things for me, because I was always focused on black or white and all these different things. And he kind of just removed that. And our relationship grew. It grew a lot. Now, I go to his house. We go out on barbecues. He's introduced me to his family, and I go to church with him to Eden Prairie Assemblies of God. And he introduces me as his son. And that's crazy. Someone from the opposite end of the spectrum of my life. Like, I was a criminal. He's a judge and was a cop and a lawyer. And like, that's like my spiritual father right now.
That's beautiful.
He's helped me get into school. I'm in the process of getting into North Central right now, actually.
Nice. George, let's remind our audience how important it is for people to speak truth into people's lives and invest in people. Like this mentor that Rolando has is such a significant person in his life, making such a significant difference.
You know, we've talked many times, you and I, off the air, Bill, about how lucky we were to have the dads that we did and that we knew in our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the mentors in Christianity and people that tell you who you really are according to God, it's the whole difference. And how can you not improve when you realize that Jesus did everything for you? I think for me, it starts with, he forgave me of my sins. I haven't forgiven me of my sins. He has. And so you have the freedom now to let go of that as far as the East is from the West.
Yeah.
You're a different guy. And that's a start that's really big, I think, of that. Knowing who you are, that God says who you are, not what you think you are.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I know I brought this up before, but I think of Jesus coming out of the waters of baptism and the heavens part. A dove descends, and the voice of God said, "This is my son whom I love, with whom I'm well pleased." That's pretty important for a man to hear.
You know, what helped me a lot is Psalms 139. I used to read that every day, twice a day, in the morning, at night, and put my name into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I start, you know, at first I'm like, okay, well, this is kind of corny. I'm not going to, you know, and I kept doing it and kept doing it. And so, you know, I'm fearfully, wonderfully made, and just kept going over it, and, you know, and replacing my name with it. And slowly I started to believe it. At first I'm like, okay, but like, I started to pray about it and talk to people and meditate. And like, I started to believe, because I carried around my burdens of all my sins and things that I've done and bad decisions in the way I thought I carried around. And it's been really hard to let that go, but it hasn't, you know, I've known what I've done, but I've got to know that I am forgiven. I'm not who I was yesterday. I'm not that person. And I have a new life, and I have meaning. I have purpose, and I have reasons to live now.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're so glad you're with us tonight. Rolando is our special guest, and we'll be right back. So glad to be back with you tonight, Bill and George. We've got Rolando as our guest, and we're hearing quite a story tonight, George. Excited to hear what God is doing in his life today and
Absolutely.
How he continues to work his recovery program. So, Rolando, let's ask. We want to ask what work has God got for you right now? What are you doing?
Oh, wow. That's a pretty big question right now. Well, so since I've been out of the program, I've got an internship at Know the Truth, which is a prevention program.
Okay.
It's a part of Minnesota Dawn Teen Challenge, where I'm a youth prevention advocate. I'm going into high schools and middle schools and ALCs and talking about drug awareness and prevention with the students, and not like the old school DARE program and like, don't do drugs. It's more or less like having a conversation like, this is my history with drugs. This is why I use. This is how bad I got. And this is what I did about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here to help you guys in any way possible. And that's been really cool. So I've been doing that. I'm actually in the process of becoming a PRSS, getting certified for that. I just did that today, which is a peer recovery support specialist, just a peer-to-peer approach on recovery to help other people in recovery as well. So I'm good at breaking down my story, what I've been through, and talking about it and relating to people on that level. So I'm trying to push that as much as far as I can. I actually am in the process of I filled out for North Central University. I have a huge support system with the church I go to, and my mentor and a lot of people that have been through North Central. The pastor of Eden Prairie Assemblies of God, he was a professor there. And he was encouraging me to go there, and I met a lot of the staff. I applied. I had to go back and take my ACTs, which was like 10 years late, which wasn't the easiest thing to do. I went and did that. And I applied. I'm waiting to hear back what happens with that. I filled out they have a George Floyd Memorial Scholarship that is a 4-year full ride that they pick one person of African American descent and pay for their school. So I'm waiting to hear back on that, which is huge. So, I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to go for yet. They have an exploratory major to, you know, just take your generals, get that on the way and figure out what's next. But I'm focusing on getting associates, but I've been thinking about trying to find a spot in law and going to practice law for my bachelor's and try to use everything I've been through when it comes to crime and law and try to find a way to make it work for me instead of against me and try to help, you know. Like Teen Challenge has the Second Chance Coalition right now, where they're trying to help, you know, people with felons be able to do more jobs and get more jobs, you know, and not be, you know, held back because of their criminal record.
And maybe help George get out of his parking tickets. He's got a lot of them.
Yeah. He's racking them up.
Oh yeah. He parks where he wants. Isn't that right, George?
Well, that's what the glove compartment's for, Bill.
So
yeah, go
ahead, George.
You know, God hits our heart, and all of a sudden we have goals to help other people. And it goes from, I'm going to do this. This is what I want to do. I can't get out of this cycle. This isn't going to change. And now we're going to help other people. And we always say on our show that God doesn't save us from our addiction without having a job for us to do. So good for you. That's the best part of recovery.
That's so true.
So I'm seeing other people get it. The best part. So good for you.
Yeah. Rolando, I'm curious about your family life and your family situation. How are you getting along with your siblings and relatives and all that?
It's all right. My family, I have to set healthy boundaries and limit exposure because I have a really big family. And a lot of them are still suffering from drug use and alcohol use and just abusing drugs and an unhealthy way of living. And I have to accept them for where they're at. And all I can do is pray for them and offer my support anyway. So like the job I do with Know the Truth, it's actually prepping me where I get to go use it on my family. And I mean, you know, mean the things that I'm learning to try to help is any way I can. Like I've opened the door for Teen Challenge. Now I was the first person in my family to go through a Minnesota Dawn Teen Challenge. And that kind of gave other people permission to do it now as well.
Nice.
And I've had one of my sisters came through and graduated. I have had a couple other family members come through. Not all of them made it, but now they know who to go to when they're ready to have that talk now, when they're ready to talk about. I've been labeled as the Bible thumper, and everywhere I go, they're asking, well, do you got your Bible on you? Like, the thing about it is, I don't need my Bible on me. We can have a conversation without it, you know, but I've accepted that, you know, and I they joke around, but now when they have questions, I'm the one they go to, if it's about, you know, religion or if it's about treatment or getting in help, and I'm willing to sit down and have that conversation and just be there for them.
Yeah.
And it's difficult at times because, you know, I want to like go in there and be like, well, do this. This is what worked for me. This and that. But I can't do that. I got to meet them where I'm at and just act and respond out of love and have the meaningful conversations and just be there to support.
That's really a lot of wisdom for sure.
God-given wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. When you are giving presentations in schools and you're looking out and seeing 16 and 17-year-old kids, can you see yourself out there? Can you spot the yous in the crowd pretty quickly?
Absolutely. And I pick on them too.
Do you?
Yeah. In a jokingly manner, you know, like I have a personality. I like to laugh and joke around, and I use that to set the vibe in there. So, you know, I'm not coming in there and just talking to them.
Yeah.
I'm having a conversation with them. I relate to them through video games and things I play and joke around with them and get them engaged and then, you know, drop questions. And I like to question a lot. Because even if it starts off with a goofy question, but I always lead it back to something that has to do with drugs or sobriety and recovery and mental and emotional health. I'm big on that because that was a big obstacle for me. But the one tricky thing about my job is that it's secular because it's in public schools. So
oh, sure.
Which is hard, you know, because I want to go in there and, like, I can tell them how I got sober, but I can't tell them, like, the why or where it came from.
You can on this show.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's a powerful first step because there's so many kids in this program. They might just be looking for, do you hear me? Do I matter? Does anybody care about me? And they're going to see in your eyes that you are that person, even for that hour presentation, that is caring about me, that I matter, that this person came in and is speaking something I want to know more about. You know, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and it gives me so much more motivation and energy to keep going. As long as if I get one kid that's like, look, you helped me want to not do drugs, and that changes everything, and it keeps happening, and it's empowering. And it gives me, okay, well, I talk to God, like, okay, well, obviously you're using me. I don't know what for what yet, but, like, how far are we going to go? And he keeps blowing me out of the water because I keep trying to put limits on a God that's limitless.
Mm-hmm. You guys, what I heard you say earlier, I thought that I really liked, and I was in school a long time ago, and it was all negative things about doing drugs, and then I smoked pot, and those things didn't happen. So I didn't buy any of it. But it sounds like you're talking to a lot of people that after you do this and you get stuck, here's what you do.
Yep.
And I like that a lot because that's the reality of it. Sure, we should do interdiction at first so people don't do it. But there's guys like us that are going to do it anyway. And these are the guys that are going to OD and die, you know? So I like the message of here's my story. I didn't listen to people. I did it. I thought I was cool. It worked for a while. Then it almost killed me. And here's how I got out of it.
You know, I've learned I use my story to give them the facts, stories that happened to me, and just supply them with information and leave them to make the decision on their own. Because kids these days, they're smart. You know, they just have to hear the right facts, the right stories from the right person, and it changes a lot of things. So I've learned how to basically turn my mess into a message. And
love it.
And it's, I would do it forever, this job. It's cool.
Well, I hope you do it forever, because there's a lot of work out there that needs to be done, and there's constantly a need for people with positive presentations and love and care. And if you will, I know, be used by God in many ways. And for right now, I think it's cool that you get an opportunity to be in secular environments, because the love of Christ will come out. You can't necessarily say it, but it will come out because it's who you are.
It's like undercover. If they if they ask about me, then I can tell them. So it's like I'm going on a covert mission, just hoping that they ask about God or what about my faith or what. And it's like, okay, now the gloves are off.
Well, it's like a missionary in China. You can't go and preach, but you can go teach English over there. And then that's how you start establishing relationships. So there's a lot of opportunities in your life ahead, Rolando. That's God's going to use you in important ways and make a big difference in people's lives. And I think that's the power of the story. Because the way you described your growing up, my heart just broke for you. This little kid getting bounced around, doesn't know who he is, doesn't have a way to feel like he can share what's on his little heart, you know, and people aren't listening and people are using drugs and then it's heartbreaking.
Yep,
you know, Billy, sorry. That was such a good example about the people going to China to speak English. The assumption obviously is that you have to speak Chinese too, or it won't work.
Yeah, right.
And if you're a recovering addict, you speak Chinese.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And we need people that have walked through what we're going through and gotten out of it. I always listen a lot more to those people because they've done it. And you bring that to the table. So good for you.
Yeah. Rolando, thank you so much for coming on and telling your story tonight. It's been great having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's been a powerful, powerful story. And I'm looking forward to hearing this again myself, which you can do at myfaithradio.com. If you want to send this program on to anyone, you can just head over to the Real Recovery page. And you can send it on. The podcast will be available. Thank you so much for listening tonight. Always love spending time with you. George and I are crazy about you. And so I have to say before I go. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.